Ordinarily, I would not interrupt a sermon series to preach a message for Valentine's Day. I've been in the middle of the Genesis series or other things before on a topic, or as we preach through a book, and I will pause for Mother's Day, for Father's Day. Sometimes we'll shift gears during the week of 4th of July, and we will talk about independence and celebrate our nation. Normally, I wouldn't stop what I was doing or interrupt a sermon series to say, let's talk about Valentine's Day. However, last week, as we continue our series, variation on the theme that God is near, last week we preached Abraham, or the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And we looked at three different passages of Scripture, and we ended at Genesis chapter 28. Well, it just so happens, and I say that sort of tongue-in-cheek, it probably didn't just so happen, that we ended at Genesis chapter 28, and in Genesis chapter 29, Jacob goes out into the world and looks for a wife. And so the title of the sermon today is Jacob Loved Rachel. And there's sort of a subtitle there. I've put in parentheses, what would you do for love? So turn with us, if you would, to Genesis chapter 29. We'll start reading at verse 9. And this may be a very well-known story, but it's always good to remind ourselves of the things we already know. And you may find along the way that we relearn some things, or perhaps see things in a fresh light or new again for the first time. So begin reading with us, if you would, at Genesis chapter 29. And we'll start at verse 9. Jacob has gone out on a journey, and he has discovered a group of shepherds that are keeping watch over sheep. And he has already asked questions, and they've mentioned to him this woman's name is Rachel. So in verse 9, while he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. And it came to pass, when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, that Jacob went near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth, and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. And Jacob told Rachel that he was his father's relative and that he was Rebekah's son. So she ran and told her father. Then it came to pass, when Laban heard the report about Jacob, his sister's son, that he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. So he told Laban all these things. And Laban said to him, surely you are my bone and my flesh. And he stayed with him for a month. Now there's some things happening in that passage that might sound awkward to the modern day reader or the modern listener. Today, you don't go to the family reunion to meet people you'd like to marry. But at this day, at this time, they have traveled away from home. Back in Genesis chapter 12, Abraham is told to leave Haran and go to the land that God will show him, and he settles in Canaan. Well, that was far away from home for Abraham. And in Canaan, he's not surrounded by his people. So when his grandson, Jacob, decides it's time to go out in the world, decides it's time to find a wife, he travels back home. Isaac had done something similar. Isaac didn't travel, but Abraham sent a servant back to his people and his kin, his relatives, to find a wife for Isaac and bring him back. So Isaac had a wife brought to him. Isaac's son Jacob travels back to where the family originally came from and finds an uncle, and they are related. So he goes back to where he was from and finds their their family, finds their people from which to choose a wife. And it may be awkward to us today, but in their time, for them, that's normal. If they hadn't moved so far away, he wouldn't have had to travel anywhere. He would have already been there, and he would have grown up knowing who his family was, and possibly had a marriage arranged for him at a very young age. So Jacob travels, finds Laban and his family, and they're all doing the work of keeping sheep. So in verse 13, Laban hears that he's there. He travels out, he embraced him, and he kissed him. Now, I did not get embraced and kissed by my father-in-law the first time I went to meet Teresa's parents. See, there's some things here that are just not the way we do them today. But there are some things that never change. I taught world history for 8 years, and I would tell my kids during the first week of school, technology has changed. Instead of carving things from wood by hand, we now have machines that pour resin into molds, and things are mass-produced instead of handmade very slowly. But we all have the same basic needs, and we all have the same basic desires. Today, armies can go to the computer, and they can have satellites spy on the enemy instead of sending people there and coming back with a report. We can make drone strikes, and we can launch missiles from hundreds of miles away. Whereas used to, you actually had to meet the person on the battlefield in order to do battle. Technology has changed. Political boundaries have changed. Cities have risen and fallen as empires come and go. I always told my kids it's a bad idea to try to take over the world. You're probably going to fail. And even if you do, it will not last very long. The Roman Empire was very successful at conquering the entire region surrounding the Mediterranean. Alexander the Great conquered everything he knew about, with the exception of China. And the only reason he didn't invade China was his men were tired and wanted to go back home and hadn't been in 3 years. But then he got sick and died before he made it home. Not a good idea to try to take over the entire world. Empires rise and fall. And even in the Old Testament, the Bible, we can see the Babylonian Empire rose, and then the Assyrians rose, and there's one empire after another, and finally we get to the Roman Empire. Empires come and go. Political boundary lines change. Every time there's a war in Europe, the map changes. If we had a map of Europe in 1900, there would be some countries on there that you would not recognize. Up until World War I, there was still an Ottoman Empire. It was smaller and weaker than it had been. And as a last-ditch effort to try to keep from fading from existence, they joined with Germany. There's going to be a war. They tried to pick the winning side. They picked badly. And after World War I, the Ottoman Empire ceased to be. But new countries were created at the end of World War I. And then those countries combine or split or disappear again when we fight World War II. And unbeknownst to many Americans, there was civil war, and there were countries splitting and reuniting during the 1990s. That didn't affect us, and Americans have a tendency not to know sometimes what's going on in the rest of the world. Things change, but people really don't. The same drives that Adam and Eve and their children had thousands of years ago, the same struggles, the same desires for power, for knowledge. The relationships between men and women, our thoughts and feelings toward our enemies, our thoughts and feelings toward our friends, our thoughts and feelings toward members of the opposite gender, and humanity's response to God. Those things are constant as long as there have been people. I don't know what new technologies will come in the years and the decades ahead? Will Johanna drive a car? Or by the time she is 16 years old, will she just get in a car and tell it where she wants to go? I know that when I was a kid, I was expecting moving sidewalks and flying backpacks by the time I was grown, and my flying backpack never arrived. Remember the Jetsons? That's what we all thought the future would look like. Well, that future didn't happen. But we do have the internet, and we do have Wi-Fi, and I can ask my phone any question in the world, and it'll immediately have an answer. I may need to do some research. It may not immediately give me the right answer, but it will answer the question. The world has changed as far as how we do things, how we get places. Technology changes, methods of manufacturing change, governments and institutions change. People tend to remain the same. People don't change. And I don't just mean a person that has qualities you would like to see change or you have habits that you would like to break. From one generation to the next, how we are wired up here stays the same. Jacob went out into the world. He saw a woman, and he got those little hearts and butterflies flying around his head and the little googly eyes, I imagine. He rolls the stone away from the mouth of the well so that Rachel could water her sheep, and he kissed her. Now today, if you walked up to a random stranger you haven't met and kissed them, there'll probably be a lawsuit or you'll be arrested. But suddenly, everything else in his world didn't matter, and he needs to find this girl and tell her that he loves her. Some things don't change. Let's continue at verse 15. And I have to find ways to say things in mixed company because we're at church on Sunday morning. Then Laban said to Jacob, "Because you are my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what should your wages be?" Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, or Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were delicate, but Rachel was beautiful of form and appearance. What other translations I've read said that Leah's eyes were weak, and that could mean a couple of different things. We're not sure exactly because this text is ancient and was written in Hebrew. And we're really good with Greek because there are people in the world today that still speak Greek. The only people today that read and write in Hebrew are basically the Jews so that they can understand their ancient religious texts. And there are very few of those. So even though there are scholars of the Old Testament, and even though there are Orthodox Jews still in the world today, there are so few of those people that Hebrew is considered a dead language. Even though there are people that study how to read it and write it and translate it, those numbers are few. And some words have simply been lost. Sometimes in a study Bible, you'll read a word and there's a footnote and it will say the exact meaning is uncertain. Scholars disagree about how to translate that. So if Leah was weak-eyed, perhaps that means she squinted a lot and had trouble seeing. It might mean she was kind of hard to look at. For whatever reason, Leah's appearance and the effect that she had on Jacob were not the same as the younger sister, Rachel. The New King James described Rachel as being beautiful of form and appearance. Some things haven't changed. And Jacob is naturally drawn to the better looking and the younger of the two sisters. Now Jacob loved Rachel, we're told in verse 18. So he said, "I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter." If you've been wondering when we would get to the fill in the blanks, the first fill in the blank, Jacob worked for 7 years for Rachel that seemed to him like days. We haven't read that verse yet, but Jacob was in love. And sometimes when you're in love, you reprioritize the importance of things. Laban said, there's no reason you should work for nothing. Tell me what you would like. So Jacob loved Rachel and said, I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. Now in verse 19, notice what Laban says. And Laban said, it is better that I give her to you than I should give her to another man. Stay with me. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for her. Love makes us do strange things sometimes. Young men write poetry and compose sonnets, or they make a mixtape, or they send cards and letters. And then after being married, the wives are like, how come you don't write me poetry anymore? And the guy will say, well, that's stuff I did before I got married. I'm married now. Some women are okay with that. And their husbands no longer have to take them to plays or to the ballet. And some women are not okay with that. And they wish to continue to be courted. Love makes men and women sometimes do strange things or make irrational decisions. But in Jacob's case, it's working out. He agreed to work for 7 years, serving Laban, doing manual labor. He's going to live there. He's going to work there. And in exchange, he will get to marry Rachel, the daughter that he loves. But in verse 21, then Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go into her. And Laban gathered together all the men of the place and made a feast. We have a reception today after weddings, but it is nothing compared to what they did in Israel. When you're reading about Joseph, or when you're reading about Jesus and his mother Mary attending a wedding, it's a big deal if you travel out of town, so you don't just go and come back the same day. A wedding feast might go on for several days, particularly if the family is wealthy. The wedding festival, the wedding feast, could go on for a week, and it's just a party every single night. So when it says Laban made a feast, that's a big deal. They didn't just go down to Ryan's and have steak or whatever they were serving on the buffet that day. Laban gathered all the men of the place and made a feast. Now it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to Jacob, and he went in to her. Without saying everything in the text, they had a great feast. It was a festival. They all had a good time. And without saying here that Jacob was probably drinking, we can gather from what we know of the time period and the culture, he was probably drinking. He was exhausted. He partied. He ate well. He drank well. And Laban pulls a fast one and gives him Leah to marry instead of Rachel. Now it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought to Jacob, and he went unto her, and Laban gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. Verse 25, so it came to pass in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, what is this you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served you? Why have you deceived me? And Laban explains in verse 26, it must not be done so in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Fulfill her week, and we will give you this one also for the service which you will serve me another 7 years. Now it makes sense that Laban wants to marry off his older daughter before the younger daughter. That was traditionally the way things were done. But back when we read verse 18, Jacob says, I'll work for you 7 years in exchange for Rachel. And Laban says, that sounds good to me. So it's not just a matter of tradition. It's not just a matter of the way things were done in this family or in this culture. Laban did pull some punches. He did say, I will let you, it's better that I give her to you than I give her to another man. So Jacob stayed and worked the 7 years. And then, after Jacob has worked 7 years, Laban says, well, I can't give you the younger daughter, and the older daughter's not married yet. Maybe he was hoping somewhere along the way, someone would come along and marry Leah, and by the time Jacob's 7 years were up, it wouldn't be a big deal. But that didn't happen. And to Jacob, it is a big deal. So Laban says, no, we don't do that. I can't give you the younger daughter before the older daughter. He's like, I will also give you Rachel if you stay and work another 7 years. Maybe when Laban said, I will give her to you to marry, he meant it. Maybe Jacob was a really good worker. Maybe he's looking at the work the other guys are doing and thinking, I got to find some way to keep this guy here longer. We don't know. I'm speculating possibilities. Maybe Laban had ulterior motives from day one. We don't know exactly what his thought process is. We don't know exactly why he says to Jacob, I can't give you the younger daughter and the older one be unmarried. But he didn't say that back when Jacob says, I'll work for you 7 years in exchange for Rachel. So in verse 28, Jacob did so. He fulfilled her week, which means he was married to Leah for 1 week. That would have been perhaps what we call a honeymoon today. So he gave her his daughter Rachel as a wife also. So Jacob has worked 7 years. He now has two wives, but he's going to have to work 7 years, according to Laban, to earn that second wife. And in verse 29, Laban gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as a maid. Then Jacob also went into Rachel, and he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban still another 7 years. And if you're doing the math, that's 14. So Jacob worked 7 more years to marry Rachel as your second. Fill in the blank. Jacob worked for 7 years for Rachel that seemed like only days because he was in love. In the movie Bambi, the characters get Twitter-pated in the spring of the year. And then Jacob worked 7 more years to marry Rachel after there was some shady dealings with how Laban honors a covenant. If you continue reading, and we're going to stop there at verse 30. If you continue reading, it gets kind of like a soap opera. If you've never read these passages, finish 29, read through 30, it gets absolutely foolish because the one wife is jealous of the other wife, and one of them is having children and the other one is not. So one wife was, so Leah is jealous because Jacob loves Rachel more, but Leah's having children and Rachel is jealous of Leah because she's given Jacob all of these kids. And then they start wheeling and dealing. They start making bargains between each other. Who gets to have Jacob? And it really does get ridiculous. And at one point, there's like a basket of fruit that's traded in exchange for spending a night with the husband. And it gets really like a soap opera. It gets really foolish with the drama. And finally, Jacob decides he can't stay there anymore. He's going to be working for Laban forever. So he takes his wives and packs up his things and cuts out in the middle of the night. And then Laban pursues after him and catches him along the way. And he's like, what are you doing? And Jacob's like, I got to get out of here. And it's like watching a movie today or reading a novel. Not going to the library and reading a classic novel like you're in the grocery store and they got the novels with the Fabio-looking guy with the blonde hair on the front cover, the $2 or $3 novels, the Harlequin romance novels. It really does get kind of ridiculous. But these two different women and the children they're having, and the reason it mentioned Laban gave this handmaid to Leah and gave this person as a maid for Rachel is they're going to have children also. So Leah's going to have children, and then Rachel's handmaid is going to have a child, and then Leah's handmaid is going to have a child, and finally Rachel herself pleads with God and is given either one or two children. I'd have to look into it. There's going to be a total of 12 sons eventually. Because that fulfills the prophecy. That fulfills the covenant God made with this family. He said to Abraham, your descendants are going to be innumerable, like trying to count the stars in the sky, or like trying to count the grains of sand by the sea. And he renewed that covenant with Isaac, and he renewed that covenant with Jacob. So all of this foolishness and this drama and the lust and the love and the jealousy play out. And yet in the midst of all that human foolishness, and you've heard me say before, people are stupid, and I know because I'm a people, God's purposes were being fulfilled. And those 12 individuals are going to become the patriarchs from which their descendants form the nation of Israel. So your last fill in the blank, and it's important for us to keep in mind sometimes even today. God uses us despite our foolishness in His service. God uses us, God uses men and women in the church today, despite our foolishness in His service. Sometimes there is family drama. We don't like to think about it. Sometimes there's church drama. We are perhaps fortunate that there are so few of us here that we don't take sides and divvy up against each other. That there's not a deacon over here and a deacon over here, and there's people that agree with him and there's people that agree with him, or there's two powerful families in the church and everybody takes one side or another. I've seen some churches split in half. Not over do they agree that the Bible is the Word of God or is Jesus God's only Son. It's never over theology or doctrine. It's which family has political power in the organization of the church. It's who cheated who and who shared what rumors. Sometimes there's family drama. Sometimes there's drama inside the church. Some years ago, Blackwood Springs split almost in half, and the argument was over whether or not they would stay in the Southern Baptist Convention. And I don't remember which side the pastor was on, but approximately half the church agreed with the pastor, and the other half wanted to do the other thing, and they finally had a vote. They announced ahead of time in their conference they would vote on staying in the convention or leaving. And the convention actually sent a moderator. I don't know if that person came from the state office in Duluth or if it was the local Baptist Association, but they actually sent a moderator to that church, and they had a roll call vote. They went down the roll and called each person's name, and each person there said yay or nay. And people showed up for that vote that had not been to church in 10 years because their name was on the membership roll. They had a full house for the most ridiculous reason imaginable to come to church and have a full house. It wasn't to worship. They didn't come to meet God. And the vote was very close. And the pastor took 50% of the members. I don't remember if the pastor stayed and the other 50% left, or the pastor was on the losing side and he left, but the church split in half. The next week, only half the people were still there and the other half went somewhere else and started themselves another church. Blackwood Springs today is in the association. So I think those people that lost went up the road and started either Maranatha or Philadelphia, because that's where new church plants come from in our day and age. It's from churches splitting in half. Not because there's so many of them and they need to move or expand. But despite our foolishness, Despite our sinful nature, because we can never be fully conformed into the image of God's Son, God uses men and women. God uses families that are sometimes broken. God uses individuals that have a past. Perhaps at some time or another they've been shattered. God uses people that are broken. And sometimes things that are small and weak in His service to do things for the kingdom of God. Look at the disciples that Jesus called. They were fishermen. They were laborers. Matthew was a tax collector, so he was probably educated and he was probably wealthy, but that was stolen money. He certainly didn't have any friends. The Jews didn't like the publicans because they worked for the Roman Empire. And the Romans never really fully accepted them because they were Jewish and the Romans hated that race. It was good money, but it was a lonely existence to be shunned by your own people. And that's who Jesus chose to serve him. Jesus says to the man that betrayed him three times in the same night, just a few days later, "I want you to lead my sheep. Do you love me? Feed my sheep, Peter." And that's the man that denied three times he even knew who Jesus was and finally invoked a curse on himself. God uses things that are small, things that are broken. God puts people's lives and people's hearts back together. Have you ever dropped a cup or a saucer? Or have you ever broken a porcelain doll and tried to glue the pieces back together? Sometimes you get away with that and sometimes you make a mess. God uses things that are small. God uses things that are rejected by the world. The Sunday school lesson this morning was about the cornerstone on which the kingdom of God is built. It's God's chosen Son, but He's the stone that the builders rejected. God uses things that are rejected by the world and unwanted. He uses people, He uses families that are small and that are broken and that the world perhaps has rejected. Sometimes we feel that way about ourselves. That we are unwanted, that we are broken, that there is something wrong with us. That's exactly what God uses to do His work and to share His word. So when you feel that way, just remember, Uncle Sam may be looking for 18 years old and physically strong and a good head to serve him. When you feel unwanted, when you feel tired or rejected, or look at your past and realize you're broken, that's what God is looking for. Let me make my point, because that wasn't exactly supposed to be it. Jacob worked for 7 years, and then Jacob worked for 7 more years because he loved Rachel. What would you do for love? I can tell you what God did for love. What God did was offered up His only Son, whom He also loved, because He loves you and I. Think about those missionaries that travel to foreign countries and never come back home. Think about the Lottie Moon story we share at Christmas time. She spent all the usable years of her life on the mission field. And when she finally decided to come back home, she got sick on the boat and passed away and never made it back to the United States. What would you do for love? Sometimes we put up with each other. One of the stories that Teresa and I likes is about a couple. They were asked how they stayed married all those years, and the response was, "We just kept showing up." There used to be a time when if something was broken, you had it fixed. If the sole wore off your shoe, you took it to the shoe repair, and they put them back together. If your watch stopped running in Calhoun, you went to the Calhoun watch shop. And Vincent was something of a miracle worker. used to be that when something needed repaired, it was worth the time and the expense and the labor to fix it. And today we live in a disposable society. They don't put batteries in cell phones that you can replace anymore. When the battery wears out, you just throw the phone away and get another one. If your TV quits working, it would probably cost more to fix than it would be to go to the store and buy another TV. What would you do for love? If you love your husband, or if you love your wife, if you love your family, then no matter what you would do with your cell phone or your TV, some things are worth the time and the effort and the labor and the expense to work on them until they're fixed. Love, we read in 1 Corinthians, is not selfish. It's self-sacrificing. What would you do for love? I hope it's a lot. Possibly everything. Let's pray together.